Our next cases this morning are number 053336, United States against Ingram, and 053303, United States against Emerson. Ms. Law.
May it please the court. My name is Carter Law, and I'm here representing Sherman Emerson this morning on his appeal. Mr. Emerson has argued in the first two issues in our brief that the evidence was insufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he ever became a member of the conspiracy charged or actively participated in it, and number two, that the district court erred in denying his motion for a mistrial when Kenneth Martinez, who was initially the government's witness and eventually became Mr. Ingram's witness, testified about a prior drug robbery with eerily similar facts to the robbery as alleged in the instant offense. The district court, with respect to the sufficiency argument, had likened Mr. Emerson to, in a sports analogy, to a player who was on the bench. If the court recalls the transcribed conversations that are of key importance to Mr. Emerson's claim, are November 20th, 2004, actually videotape with audio of a meeting in a motel room, a Holiday Inn in Indianapolis, and of an audio recording of a conversation between Mr. Emerson, Mr. Douglas, who was the confidential informant, and Mr. Ingram, his co-defendant, on the 2nd of December.
That on the bench is an interesting analogy, because if you're on the bench, you're still on the team, and that's the allegation here, that Emerson was going to get some of the money.
Judge, I appreciate very much your point, and indeed you absolutely went exactly where I was going. Mr. Emerson's argument, and I believe the facts support a finding that indeed Mr. Emerson never made the team. Mr. Emerson came to the November 20th meeting alone. He came at Mr. Ingram's behest. He did, in fact, make some comments during those conversations. But when we get to the December 2nd conversation, it becomes very clear that the members of the conspiracy had been, I think it's fair to say,
they were queasy about Emerson being involved.
They were definitely queasy, Judge.
But had this not been a set-up deal and had it gone through, wouldn't the evidence support a finding that Emerson was going to get some of the proceeds?
Well, of course, that's a speculation that we don't know about, Judge. But I think if you look at the transcript from the 2nd of December, first of all, the confidential informant is the one who is continuously saying, you know, even if you don't go, we'll give you something. And in the second, in the conversation, and it's hard to appreciate on the cold written record, although it appears from the written transcript of that conversation that Mr. Ingram and Mr. Emerson became quite heated in their argument. And indeed, Mr. Emerson was not arguing that he'd be permitted to stay in. He says at least three times, I don't want anything to do with these fake goofballs. I'm happy this happened. I'm glad this came out. I don't want anything to do with them. And the confidential informant said, I'll tell you what, we'll give you something anyway. And Mr. Ingram eventually said, and it's on, I want to say it's on page 31 of the transcript, which I think was Exhibit 5, or 10 or 11 below, I'll tell you what, I'm going to get 3.5 birds, we're going to step on it and make it 7, which I believe referred to kilograms, and I can see what's going to happen. You're going to say to me, I'm going to say, Sherman, what are you doing? You're going to say, I need gas money. And I'm going to say, here, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $500 and 5 ounces. Go do what I've been doing this for Sherman for years. There's simply, and I think what's maybe more compelling, Judge, number one, he doesn't have a gun, and that's a requirement throughout. You can't do it if you don't have a gun. And I think if you go to the December 4th transcript, which is the night before the actual robbery was supposed to happen, and all of the members, of course, notable in his absence was Mr. Emerson, had gathered in a hotel room to discuss final plans. And as they were discussing it and talking about putting all of their guns in a bag the next morning, I think Agent Canino had suggested that they do that, they were talking about who had what kind of gun. And one man, I think he's called Rob or Raj, says, I'm going to have a 47. I want to have something big. And Canino's ears immediately perk up, and he says, you don't have a gun now? And the man says, oh, but I will by tomorrow morning at 9:30. Agent Canino immediately says, within the very next line, well, then maybe you're going to have to be a lookout or a driver. In other words, and they literally say, if you want a piece, you're going to have to play a role. Nobody ever suggested that Sherman Emerson was going to play any role. And quite honestly, the government's suggestion that by staying away, he was ensuring the success of the venture turns any kind of criminal liability on its ear. There simply isn't any evidence that this man ever was given, was recognized as providing mutual support for this enterprise. He, as I've said, he came, he showed interest at the first meeting, he wasn't picked for the team, he wasn't on the bench, he wasn't even at the game. He didn't come to any games. And they didn't say, I'll tell you what, Sherman, you can sit on the bench and hold the towels, or you can bring the Gatorade, or you can wipe off somebody's forehead. Nothing. And so my suggestion is that when Mr. Ingram said, I'll give you something, number one, I think it was to assuage Mr. Emerson's anger at his old friend not standing up for him. But number two, it was perfectly gratuitous. It wasn't in response or in recognition of any role. There was never a role discussed for Mr. Emerson to play. And I see that it's time for Mr. McKinley, and I'll reserve further for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. James McKinley with the Federal Defender's Office in Indianapolis, representing William Ingram in this appeal. Mr. Ingram, unlike Mr. Emerson, chose to take the stand at trial and assert an entrapment defense. In short, he maintained that he had been threatened, he'd been coerced by the confidential informant, a man that he feared. He'd been threatened to participate in this conspiracy. He maintained that the confidential informant was in turn acting at the behest of Detective Martinez, and that Mr. Ingram maintained that he had been unfairly targeted by Detective Martinez because Detective Martinez had been the lead investigator in a case where Mr. Ingram had previously been arrested and charged with murder in connection with a drug robbery. We, in fact, called Detective Martinez to the stand during the defense case in chief to corroborate Mr. Ingram's assertion that Detective Martinez had threatened him while he had been awaiting trial at the jail. And on cross-examination, the prosecutor seized the opportunity to reveal to the jury that the prior offense for which Mr. Ingram was charged was, in fact, a murder that had occurred during the course of a drug robbery. And over a defense objection, the prosecutor further revealed that the murder case had been dismissed due to the fact that a key state witness had died mysteriously prior to trial.
You agree that when you raise an entrapment defense, you're pretty much opening up your whole life to the jury because your background, your predisposition to commit a crime is a very important factor.
Granted, Your Honor, when predisposition becomes an issue, certainly it opens the door for a lot of things. And that's precisely what the district court ruled here. And what the government argues on appeal is that entrapment opened the door. We disagree. Rule 404B clearly allows prior bad act evidence to be introduced when predisposition is at issue, like it was in this case. But admission is still subject to the evidence being sufficient to support a jury finding that the person actually committed the prior bad act. It's also subject to a determination that any probative value is
outweighed
by...
That would be true of a conviction, but not of a bad act. What you've just said is true of a conviction, but not a bad act. If you're asking, do they have to have just belief, a sincere belief that what they're asking is true?
Well, Your Honor, the...
Was there anything that they brought out in cross-examination that was false?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, did you...
Well, was there anything that they brought out on cross-examination that elicited something that was false?
No, no. There was no false testimony in this regard. But our point is this. We submit that even though a prior conviction might be clearly sufficient to support a juror finding that the person committed the prior bad act, the fact that a person had been arrested and only arrested is insufficient to support a jury finding that the person had, in fact, committed the prior bad act. Now, the government goes on to argue harmless error here, saying, well, the other evidence is overwhelming. Well, the evidence may be overwhelming in the view of government counsel in this case, but I don't think it's so overwhelming when it's considered in the context of Mr. Ingram's testimony that he was threatened, he was coerced, he was told what to do, what to say, and how to act when in the presence of the confidential informant. The jury, of course, had a choice whether to believe him or not. They chose not to believe him, but I think the issue comes down to the extent to which the jury may have been influenced by evidence of his prior arrest for murder, and it's hard to think of anything that could be more unfairly prejudicial to Mr. Ingram under the circumstances than to have the jury learn that he had previously been arrested, charged with murder that occurred during a drug robbery similar to what was set up here. Indeed, this is the kind of testimony that creates such a risk of prejudice that any limiting or curative instruction here to expect the jury to follow it, I think, ignores the practical and human limitations of the jury system. In the time that I have allotted, I want to touch briefly on our argument concerning the admission of the audio tape recordings. There was a December 2nd, 2004 recording involving Mr. Douglas, the confidential informant, Mr. Ingram, and Mr. Emerson. And then there was the recording that was made in the U.S. Marshal transport van following the arrest. The rule 901 clearly requires the government to show by clear and convincing evidence that the proper tapes were true, accurate, and authentic recordings of the conversation between the parties. And this was the basis for our objection to both recordings. Typically, that's showed either by a chain of custody or by offering testimony of a participant or an eyewitness to the conversation who could testify that it accurately reflects the conversation. With regard to the December 2nd tape, the only evidence as to authenticity was presented by Detective Martinez, who said he gave the body wire to the informant, he recovered it from him, and he listened to it and he recognized the voices on. I didn't cite in our brief because I couldn't find any decisions out of this court where this court has found that authentication was insufficient, but my research also failed to reveal any case upholding admission and finding authentication to be sufficient based on evidence as limited as it was here. I see I'm cutting into my rebuttal time. So,
can you just answer your question? Was there a motion to sever the trials in this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was there a motion to separate the trials, have separate trials?
I don't understand the question,
Your Honor. Was there a motion to sever so that each defendant received separate trials,
no,
one apart from another?
I don't believe there was a motion to sever in this case, Your Honor.
Because it seems sort of, I'd hate to be the defendant going to trial with the co-defendant raising an entrapment defense where you have to admit absolutely everything.
Establish
entrapment, you have to admit you did it.
Yeah, obviously their sessions were significantly different. There was no question that there was substantial evidence of Mr. Ingram's direct involvement, and the line of defenses, they were clearly distinct, but their circumstances were so different that that motion to sever the trial were not made in this case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Mr. Glickman now.
May it please the court, I'm Barry Glickman. I'm an assistant United States attorney in Indianapolis, Indiana. I was trial counsel below. Addressing the issues in the defendant's brief seriatim, if I could, beginning with Mr. Emerson's argument that the evidence was insufficient to establish that he was a member of the charged conspiracy. I would respectfully submit to this court that the evidence was overwhelming that Mr. Emerson was a member of the charged conspiracy. And if the court will permit me a little leeway to just give a little background on the conspiracy and when Mr. Emerson came in, I think this shows the nature of the evidence against him. On November the 19th of 2004, Mr. Ingram, who was indisputably the leader and the organizer of this conspiracy, met with Special Agent Canino of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, and Mr. Douglas, the informant. And he was presented a scenario where Mr. Ingram could obtain a large amount of cocaine, 20 kilograms of cocaine, on this occasion. Mr. Ingram jumped at the chance. Mr. Ingram called this a lifetime opportunity, said that he'd been wanting to do this since he got out of prison, said that he'd been planning a robbery like this, and Mr. Ingram said that he would assemble a crew of what he called six killers. He said that all the killers that he had would be strapped, which is a street term for being armed. He said that his killers would force the owners of the cocaine to lay down. They would duct tape them. They would steal the cocaine, and they would split it with Special Agent Canino on a 10-10 split. Now, what counsel for Mr. Ingram has ignored in her brief and before the court this morning is that on that November 19th meeting, there was talk by Mr. Ingram of being so excited at this opportunity that he wanted to do another lick, another armed robbery of multiple kilograms of cocaine in the next few weeks. And that meeting ended with Mr. Ingram saying that he would bring his killers, his crew of killers, over the next day for Special Agent Canino to meet them. The next day, on the 20th of November, there's a meeting in which Mr. Ingram, Mr. Emerson, Special Agent Canino, the informant, and two others are present. At this meeting, Mr. Ingram detailed how the lick was going to occur. He told everybody there, including Mr. Emerson, that there's 20 kilograms of cocaine involved. There's six of us going in. We're going to wear masks and gloves during the robbery. And then he said, we all know how to do robberies like this because we've all done them before. And he said that everybody who participated would get a bird or a kilogram of cocaine. And on two separate occasions, Special Agent Canino asked Mr. Ingram, was this the team? And Mr. Ingram said, there might be one more. But the analogy that Judge Hamilton initially came up with, and that Your Honor continued with today, is entirely accurate about what was happening. There, because of this talk of other licks, and indeed at this meeting, toward the end of it, on page 31 of Government's Exhibit 5, Mr. Ingram said in front of the whole group to Special Agent Canino, let's say your guy had 50 birds. You tell us, we'll go get it. After we do this one time, we can do it the way we talked about yesterday, and we can get this 10, 20, 30, 40, whatever. So instead of a one-shot deal, Mr. Ingram, being the organizer and leader of this conspiracy, clearly thought that this was going to be an ongoing opportunity where they would have the opportunity to commit armed robberies of multiple kilograms of cocaine. That's important because when we get to the December meeting, that's important why Mr. Emerson was kept on the bench for this lick. Now, Mr. Emerson, he was an active participant at this November the 20th meeting. He asked details about the lick. When was it going to go down? Would the warehouse where the coke was being stored be left open? He expressed concern that he didn't have a heater. And then when Special Agent Canino asked the group, does anybody have any questions, Mr. Emerson replied, I'm used to it. I don't have any questions, and that was followed by an expletive. Sometime between that meeting and the actual day that the cocaine was going to be stolen on, or what Mr. Ingram and Mr. Emerson and the rest of the crew thought was going to be cocaine was going to be stolen on, there was a meeting between Mr. Ingram, Mr. Emerson, and the informant. And it was at that meeting that we learned and that the jury heard about, there was concern expressed by Mr. Ingram and other members of the conspiracy about Mr. Emerson wanting to kill the owners of the cocaine on this particular lick. The reasonable inference from the evidence and the reasonable inference was that this was only going to be one of a few future licks that this crew involving Mr. Ingram, Mr. Emerson, and the others were going to do. So if it was a one-shot deal, perhaps the fact that Mr. Emerson said that he wanted to kill the owners of the cocaine would have been of no consequence. But it was of tremendous consequence in this case. It was of tremendous consequence because if Mr. Emerson was permitted, and at this point he's in the conspiracy, there's no question about it. If he was permitted to accompany the others on this drug lick, the potential for future licks would have gone out the window if he would have killed the owners of the cocaine in Mr. Ingram and the others' mind. So there's some discussion back and forth about what Mr. Ingram said. Mr. Emerson said he didn't say that he was going to kill the owners of the cocaine. He just said if something fouled up, we'll have to smoke them or kill them, and that's what he's going to do. Then at that point, Mr. Emerson indicated that he said, quote, "I got a shotgun. I'm going to put a body on that." Mr. Ingram, who's the coach of the team or the leader of this conspiracy, decided that it would be in the best interest of the conspiracy to keep Mr. Emerson, who was obviously a little trigger-happy, on the bench for this particular lick. And I would respectfully submit that by Mr. Emerson being placed on the bench and not being able to play in the game or going on this particular lick, this ensured the success of this first lick and of the conspiracy. All that notwithstanding, there's no evidence and there's nothing that counsel for Mr. Emerson can point to that would demonstrate that he withdrew from the conspiracy or that he was excluded from it. On the contrary, as we know, he was promised the proceeds of this robbery. And this is analogous to someone who agrees with a number of people to rob a bank, and this person actually doesn't go into the bank, but gets the proceeds by either keeping quiet or not going to the police. It's the same scenario that happened here. Moving on to the second issue in the defendant's brief, the motion for the mistrial. I would respectfully submit to the court that the district court did not abuse its discretion by not granting this motion. As the court knows, Mr. Ingram testified and crafted a somewhat clever defense that he was both entrapped as well as unfairly targeted for prosecution by law enforcement and by one particular Indianapolis Police Department homicide detective in particular. Now, obviously, the jury didn't believe Mr. Ingram's claim that he was coerced. And indeed, Mr. Ingram, who testified at trial, made a number of outlandish claims which the jury rejected, such as the fact that he wasn't on those tapes, which we played for the jury in court. But it was in response to a question by counsel for Mr. Ingram, and it was counsel for Mr. Ingram who brought up this case in the first place. Counsel for Mr. Ingram elicited the fact that Detective Martinez was a chief investigator in another case that involved Mr. Ingram and that the charges were dropped. That was the evidence is undisputed that that was brought up and elicited by counsel for Mr. Ingram. Mr. Ingram clearly, his counsel opened the door to further testimony about the case and why it was dropped, and indeed the case went to rebut Mr. Ingram's lack of predisposition to commit the offense. As I did state in the government's brief, the evidence was not properly before the jury with respect to Mr. Emerson. And with respect for that, I would respectfully submit that the evidence was not referred to again in any other way. There was nothing further presented to the jury on this point implicating Mr. Emerson. And as I indicated earlier, the evidence was overwhelming against both Mr. Ingram and Mr. Emerson. In addition to that, I would respectfully submit that Judge Hamilton did an excellent job in instructing the jury about its use or how it wasn't supposed to use this evidence. Counsel for
Mr. Ingram, or Mr. Emerson, rather, did not request a curative instruction. However, Judge Hamilton told the jury that they were not to consider the 2001 case against Mr. Emerson at all, and with respect to Mr. Ingram, the jury was only to consider it insofar as it would help them with Ingram's assertion that Detective Martinez and law enforcement had targeted him unfairly for investigation and prosecution. And he also, Judge Hamilton also instructed the jury that other acts against Mr. Ingram would be to consider it on the question of entrapment, and they were not relevant in any way to any charge against Mr. Emerson. And then touching on the admissibility of the tapes, I would respectfully submit to the court that an adequate predicate was laid for the admission of these tapes, both on December the 2nd and December the 5th. With respect to the other sentencing issues, because Mr. Emerson was a co-conspirator in this case, he was a member of this conspiracy in which it was reasonably foreseeable that firearms would be possessed and used, the assessment of a two-point adjustment in his base offense level for possessing a firearm was warranted. Indeed, Mr. Emerson said himself that he had a shotgun on that December the 2nd tape. With respect to Mr. Emerson's contention that he was a minor participant, that is not borne out by the evidence. There's nothing to indicate that he was substantially less culpable than the other individuals in this case in what was going to be an ongoing conspiracy to rob large amounts of multiple kilograms of cocaine. And then finally, with respect to Mr. Ingram's sentence, Mr. Ingram was a career offender. His guidelines were found to be 360 years to life. He had a long criminal record. Judge Hamilton adequately went through the salient 3553A factors in imposing a sentence. Mr. Ingram's criminal record included possession of a sawed-off shotgun, resisting law enforcement, burglary, theft, intimidation, criminal confinement, and battery. Most notably, on the criminal confinement and battery charge, Judge Hamilton noted how Mr. Ingram broke into the house of a young female who was asleep in the early hours of the morning, and the pre-sentence report expounded on that a little more and said that Mr. Ingram at that time forced this young woman to engage in oral sex with him, and he threatened this woman and hit this woman. And this was the pattern of Mr. Ingram. He was an extremely dangerous individual, and the sentence imposed by Judge Hamilton was reasonable, it was fair, it was just, and it took into account all the 3553A factors. Beyond that, I would just rest on the arguments in the government's brief, and I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Glickman. Counsel, you have 1 minute.
I'd like just to read from the very first page of the December 2nd transcript. At this point, the confidential informant and Mr. Emerson are in the car, and the confidential informant says, and I'm quoting the government's exhibit, and I'll try to delete things that are less than savory, why the blank do you want to, you know, boot him out now? Boot him out now. Just to grab Dre and them just because they got their own heaters? What's really going on, he says, on the very next page. And then somebody comes in like, yeah, here's the team, and then you switch the team up. I don't know what boot him out means on the street, but in my years on the planet, boot him out means kick him off the team. We're referring to Mr. Emerson. Mr. Emerson says over and over and over, I don't get guns anymore. He says something about a shotgun, but he says in many other sections on this very same tape, I don't have guns. I don't even want to mess with these people anymore. Since I came home, I don't mess with anybody. I'm glad to be out of this. They're fake and they're not loyal, and I don't want anything to do with these people. That's with respect to whether or not there was evidence that he was kicked off the conspiracy. With respect to the curative instruction.
Your time has expired, I'm afraid.
Very well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Ms. Lowe, I believe you served by appointment, am I correct? You have the deep thanks of the court for your fine efforts on behalf of your client. And indeed, the court would like to thank all counsel in the case for their fine work. The case will be taken under advisement.